everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch this program by going to ustream.tv and then search for Gary Nall. You can listen over the telephone anywhere in South America, North America, Canada, by calling 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're continuing with our series on conversations with remarkable minds. The topic, what is the CIA today, and its role in domestic surveillance, the emerging police state, and the moral imperative for citizens to become activists. My guest, Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst for 7 presidential administrations, beginning with John F. Kennedy's White House to that of George H.W. Bush, and among his duties was preparing the president's daily brief, which was a one-on-one to presidential the President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam. Since retiring from government service, he has been one of our nation's most vocal peace activists and journalists. In 2003, he created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. His opinion pieces appear in many leading newspapers here and abroad, including a major section in an important book, Neocon Again, dealing with America's war in Iraq. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University and is a graduate from Harvard's Business School, and he also has a background in theology from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com or consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary.
I'd like to begin by clarifying the role of the CIA today. There was the famous German philosopher of religion, Joachim Vach, who popularized the Latin term ecclesia in ecclesiola to designate a little church that operates within a larger church with autonomy. Now, given the CIA's past history, particularly with its share of scandals that were enacted in some cases with the different branches of the government, some people say that they participated in the JFK assassination. Others say the Iran-Contra. And even now we have the black bag ops where the CIA, in concert with the National Security Agency, upload spyware on any computer they want, per an article in the journal Foreign Policy. And there's a sense that the CIA acts like a little government within the big government, and although the CIA reports to the director of the National Security Agency, it continues to have considerable autonomy to act on its own. There is the CIA's Office of Technical Collection that has been a boon for the National Security Agency, according to Foreign Policy author Matthew Aid, who says that the rate of this form of spying and eavesdropping has not been so high since the Cold War. So, as a former CIA analyst, please review for us the CIA's role today, its relationship with the National Security Agency and the White House, and to what degree does it operate independently from the national government, and then why should we be concerned about its freedom to operate without much oversight, particularly since we would never know, based upon our current notions of national security secrets, what it did. In any case, the forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, thank you, Gary. Perhaps it would be good to go back to the foundation or the founding of the CIA back in 1947, right after World War II. Its birth had a lot to do with Pearl Harbor, where there are little bits of information scattered around the government among the code breakers and the Army and the Navy, the Army Air Corps, the various embassies in Tokyo and elsewhere, open media sources. If there were one person into whose inbox, and in those days, of course, we had inboxes made out of wood. There's one person into whose inbox all that relevant information came, it would have been a no-brainer. There would have been no surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. And so Harry Truman, who, of course, experienced all this, was hell-bent and determined that the one agency, after the war, created answerable to him and him alone. In other words, not put under the Pentagon, which would make the Soviet Union out to be 10 feet tall, not put under the State Department, which was always had a incentive to defend its own policies, but someone answerable to him, someone that he could call on a noontime or have his secretary call the director of Central Intelligence and say, look, I want you and your three brightest people, most knowledgeable people on Vietnam down to my office at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I have some very, very key decisions to participate in with the president. He needs background. I need them, and I need them 3 o'clock, and they're going to have to tell me just like it is. Now, I witnessed that. I was around for that, okay? And when the blue-suited generals, in their wisdom, persuaded LBJ that there was a really good chance that if they used these new B-52s, as LBJ used to refer to them, with these great big bombs, that they could, A, seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, B, make Ho Chi Minh quit the war. LBJ asked us, what do you guys think? And we suppressed the laugh. Waited a decent interval of 2 days, and he came back and said, no, Mr. President, with all due respect, the Ho Chi Minh Trail doesn't look anything like I-66 or I-95 or any superhighway. It's about 185 trails through the woods. You can't even see parts of it from the air. And number two, we know Ho Chi Minh. I mean, our colleagues helped bring him into Hanoi when the Japanese were expelled. And so we actually brought him in on our shoulders. So we know him, and we know he's a nationalist first, not a communist. He was a communist, sure, but he was a nationalist first, and that he's not going to give up under bombing. As a matter of fact, Mr. President, you should know, no country has ever given up strictly under bombing. Now, LBJ, of course, took all that in and decided, as most presidents always decide, that the intelligence is just one input into this equation. He didn't want to be the first U.S. president to lose a war. And so he said, well, I don't know, maybe these blue-suited generals, and maybe they got it right, so might as well try it. And so he became the first U.S. president to lose a war. Now, the corollary here, of course, is that as good as the intelligence analysis can be, no president is in any way required to follow it. Now, the other part of the CIA, and I, in my lectures around the country, I really say it's a separate CIA because it really is, and it was from the beginning. I'm talking about the covert action arm, the fellows who overthrow governments and, sad to say, are suborned into torturing people, putting them in black prisons, kidnapping them, and so forth. Now, that didn't used to be quite so bad, but it was always pretty, pretty subliminally bad, okay? And what happened? Well, after World War II, the operators came back. Now, these were courageous people. These were the Office of Strategic Services people, okay? All kinds of miracles of courage and daring in the European Far Eastern theater. And they came back, 1946, 1947, and said, well, thanks a lot for all the applause. And again, the applause was well-deserved. Do you still need us? I mean, like, should we go back to our law firms or our corporations? Should we go back to Agatine, or do you need to stay around here in Washington? Now, Gary, you can visualize with the Soviets having overrun Eastern Europe, endangering the Balkans, threatening even Italy and France, the question answered itself. I mean, of course we need you. Hang around. The KGB, the Soviet secret police, was roaming all around the world to overthrowing governments. And you guys are experts in overthrowing governments or preventing the Soviets from doing it. So, yeah, hang around. And then some, I don't know what kind of, well, I'll say some idiot decided that it would be a really good idea, since this CIA that Truman intended was going to have some classified information, right? We'd have our own spies to collect information we needed for analysis. But that, you know, so it would have to be secret. Since that was the case, and since, of course, overthrowing governments and so forth, that had to be kept secret, well, we'll put them in the same place. And so you had one director responsible for objective, tell it like it is intelligence. And that same director, from time to time, ordered by the president to wage a war in Nicaragua, unleash drones in Pakistan, torture people in Guantanamo. It just never worked because no one had any credibility going up to the Hill or to the American people and talk about, for example, the war against the Nicaraguan people. You know, what credibility do you have if your director, Bill Casey, is running that war, and some congressman asks, well, how do you think that war is going, or what do you think the likely outcome of it is? So what I'm saying here is that there was a structural fault in the construction of the CIA from the beginning, that it was always two CIAs, and the one that got all the money, of course, was the one that overthrew governments and did other covert action. And, you know, see the way it plays out. Here with 47 is when the National Security Act was passed. And there was one sentence in this. Gary, you get a surprise out of this. The only thing that authorizes the second CIA, the one that came out of the OSS, the one that overthrows governments, the only thing that authorized that was one sentence included in the language of the bill just before it was passed. And that sentence reads this way. The Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the President shall from time to time direct. I'll read it again, or I'll recite it again. The Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the President shall from time to time direct. End quote. Now, what is it? What does it do? Well, in a word, we've seen what it does. If you have an unscrupulous president, if you have a president that would turn the CIA and the Army into torturers, and you have a willing, subservient, glad-handling head of the intelligence community, like we had in George Tenet, who thought that it was his job if George Bush wanted to start a war and had no real evidence to justify it, well, the Tenet thought it his duty to conjure up evidence. And we know, of course, now that the war against Iraq was not based on mistaken evidence. It was based on fraudulent evidence, forgeries and the like of it. So, in answer to your question, it depends on the president. Integrity really does count. Honesty really does count. And when you have an unscrupulous president and a similarly unscrupulous head of the intelligence apparatus, you've got real problems. You get wars of aggression, you get torture, kidnapping, black sites, and the rest of it. Now, is the CIA rogue? Well, you know, it's really hard to say that George Tenet was rogue. Was he a war criminal? Yes, anybody who enforces orders to do the kinds of things that he did through his agency, yeah, he's a war criminal. But he was a rogue? Well, the rogue was Cheney, the rogue was Bush. Now, there were times, and you know, people pretty much know this, there were times when the CIA did act in a rogue kind of way. And the best example of that was when this young John Kennedy came into office more than 50 years ago. And actually, I came down to Washington in 1963, so I remember this quite well. It was right after the Bay of Pigs invasion, okay? Now, this was a really feckless operation that had been approved by John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower himself, but it had no chance of success on its own. A bunch of ragtag emigres, a couple of thousand in Miami and elsewhere, they were going to land on the beach, and they were going to overthrow Fidel Castro. Give me a break. Now, when Kennedy came into office, you know, he had his own mettle to prove, and they said, all right, we've got this great operation. And Kennedy said, well, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but if Eisenhower approved it, just remember one thing, guys, all right? If you get in trouble, if those guys get on the beach, no U.S. Air Force, no U.S. Army, no U.S. armed forces are going to intervene. So if you think you go ahead, think you can succeed, just realize that's the condition. Now, John Foster Dulles' brother, Alan Dulles, who headed the CIA, kind of smirked, and we know he smirked, because we know from his coffee-stained notes discovered after he died in his office that he wrote, "We're going to have trouble on the beach, but no U.S. president is going to be able politically to deny us the air cover we need or the invasion forces we need to do away with Castro once and for all." All right? So what were they doing? They were blindsiding Kennedy. They thought that they could make this thing work and that he would have to come in. Of course, he stuck to his guns, literally, okay? And he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And you know the rest of the story. At that point in time, John Kennedy was quoted as saying that he wanted to break up the CIA into 1,000 pieces and let it fly to the four winds. Now, you asked another question, and it had to do with the assassination of Kennedy. And I'll tell you, Gary, that after 50 years of experience in Washington, I never thought that I would hear myself saying this, but I will. Alan Dulles was one of the most very powerful men in Washington, the head of the CIA, under Eisenhower and then Kennedy. He was the author of the Bay of Pigs, and he was willing to mousetrap the U.S. president into any manner of covert action things. Now, when Kennedy fired him after the Bay of Pigs, well, establishment Washington is not such as a guy like that is allowed to get fired, okay? They watched Kennedy, and as he opened up after the Cuban Missile Crisis, as he and Khrushchev saw it together as menschen, mensch people, as menschs, how close they were to destroying this planet, they initiated a secret correspondence. We had the Limited Test Ban Treaty. We had a very conciliatory speech by Kennedy at American University. We had feelers not only to Khrushchev, with whom he was corresponding, with whom he was communicating in a way that the CIA was not privy to, and we had him reaching out to Castro through intermediaries. But the kiss of death was that Kennedy wanted to get us out of Vietnam. I'll say that one more time because this is very controversial. Kennedy had decided that Vietnam was a fool's errand. He issued two executive orders, one to take 1,000 U.S. troops out of Vietnam by the end of 1963, and the bulk of the rest of them by the end of 1965. He orchestrated the whole thing, so he had ostensible support from Maxwell Taylor, who happened to be a general, and from McNamara, who happened to be loyal to Kennedy. And against all the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who George Ball, the Deputy Secretary of State, characterized at the time as a cesspool, against all of these Joint Chiefs of Staff, his top military, against all the others of his advisors, Kennedy faced up to the Vietnam thing and says, "We're getting out. I'm going to let these guys fend for themselves. We're not going to be upholding a dictatorship that is not going to win anyway." Now, of course, in the beginning of November 1963, Diem, the head of South Vietnam, was assassinated. And just a few weeks later, so was John Kennedy. What am I saying? I'm saying that after all the books and all the photos and all the videos and everything else, a book has been written 5 years ago. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable. It's the best. Its author is James Douglas. He's taken advantage of all these other books and the material that was released by Act of Congress a couple of years ago. He's interviewed all manner of people. And he's come up with a very convincing argument that John Kennedy was done in by a cabal led mostly by Alan Dulles, but with the cooperation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, parts of the FBI, and even parts of the Secret Service. It's very convincing, JFK and the Unspeakable. I recommend it to everyone. Now, where does that leave us? Well, what's the evidence here? Harry Truman. He's out of office, and he watches what's happened to the CIA that he created. And right after John Kennedy is assassinated in November of 1963, the 23rd, I think it was, Harry Truman corresponds with Admiral Souders, who was a Navy admiral who actually set up the CIA in its initial stages for Harry Truman, and their correspondence is available in the Harry Truman Library at Independence, Missouri. What he says is, you know, we need to speak out now. We can't stop speaking out because of what just happened. And he crafts this op-ed, which appears, mind you, in the Washington Post exactly a month later, December 23, 1963. Maybe it's 22nd, I forget that. I guess it's the 22nd. Okay, now, what did it say? It's Harry Truman, his byline. He says, I don't know what happened to the CIA that I created. I didn't expect them to be engaged in assassinations or co-conductor activities or, you know, this kind of thing. Let's get back to collecting intelligence and giving the president, unbiased views on what's going on in the world. If we're going to have a covert action wing, says Harry Truman in this op-ed, put it somewhere else, but don't put it in to corrupt the analysis of the CIA. My God, here's Harry Truman saying this exactly 1 month after John Kennedy is assassinated. Now, what happened? Well, something unprecedented in my experience happened, and I've been here 50 years. There used to be three editions of the Washington Post. Now, that op-ed appeared just in the very early edition, and it did not appear in the later two editions. In other words, it was pulled. That op-ed did not appear in any other newspaper or media source in this country except a little dinky newspaper in Independence, Missouri. It was suppressed. Now, how did that happen? Well, Bill Colby, the head of the CIA at one point, said that, you know, we have pretty much suborned, he didn't say suborned, we have great influence over every major newspaper and media figure. Well, that proves it, what happened to President Truman's op-ed. The story goes further, and I'll only carry on one more minute here, I promise, but it's so intriguing. What happens next, of course, is that Alan Dulles insinuates himself into becoming the effective chief of staff of the, guess what?
Warren Commission.
The commission to look into the assassination of John Kennedy. Alan Dulles picks the people to testify, tells other people not to testify, and he's bringing this whole thing up, and of course the Warren and the Redder people, they're happy to have somebody insider do all this, because, you know, who knows better than Alan Dulles? Well, in a sense, they're quite right, who knows better. Well, what does Alan Dulles do? Well, he's got this very troublesome Washington Post op-ed that's still out there on the record, you know. It wasn't very well publicized, but it's still there. So he drums up an engagement to make a speech in Kansas City. He goes out there and he says, oh, President Truman, may I drop in on you? Oh, sure. So he stops by at Independence, and as the Germans say, unter vier Augen, you know, under four eyes, one-on-one, he and Truman have this discussion about the op-ed. After which, Alan Dulles prepares his memorandum of conversation. Truman said, that was a great big mistake. I don't know what happened. I certainly don't believe that the CIA should be canceled out from doing these operations. And I don't know, this was just a real fluke here, you know. Now, how does Alan Dulles do all that? Well, he writes this memorandum to the fellow who is the general counsel of the CIA from forever. And he puts it in the record. Okay, so it's in the record of the CIA. So if anybody asks on the Warren Commission, well, what about Truman saying, like, God, that we shouldn't be assassinated, the CIA shouldn't be assassinated? What about? Well, then Dulles could say, well, I talked to Larry Houston, who was the general counsel of the CIA from day one until he was still there when I graduated, so to speak. Larry Houston has a memo. Ask Larry. So they dig out the memo, and the memo says, oh, yeah, well, Truman disavowed that when Alan Dulles went and saw him. Well, no way, because just a month later, Look magazine interviews Truman, and Truman says the exact same thing he said in his op-ed. So Alan Dulles, I think, orchestrated this thing in large measure, and as we celebrate, if that's the right word, as we anticipate 50 years of the killing of this young president who had his head screwed on right, but was facing the epitome of what his predecessor Eisenhower warned about, the military-industrial complex, this felt need to exert our superiority in all kinds of ways, not only vis-a-vis Cuba, but the Soviet Union, this knee-jerk aversion to letting any communists, even if Ho Chi Minh was first and foremost a nationalist, letting any communists take over any country, lest the whole area of Southeast Asia be sent into the communist orbit. All that thing was so hyped and so exaggerated, not to speak of Joe McCarthy and the rest of it, that Kennedy tried and failed, and he failed for cause. Now, these folks are still around. That's why I take you through all this. Now we've got the military, industrial, congressional, media, national security, intelligence complex.
I appreciate the depth of the answer. I want to do a follow-up, a little off the discussion, but still I feel relevant. I'm, for 37 years, on WBAI in New York, and which is part of the Pacifica Network. You could not mention 9/11 on there, or you had been railed against. That was true of all the Pacifica stations till one person had the courage to even discuss the discrepancies, only the discrepancies in the official version. Since that time, we have had scholars on this program discussing what they can prove definitely did not happen, not what they can prove did happen. So no one has come on the air here and said, well, I know what really happened. What they do say with proof to back it up is, here's what the official version says, and here's why that official version is wrong. We have over 1,300 scientists who have backgrounds in physics and in meteorology and architecture saying that the official version is just rife with contradictions. I do not believe, after all the review I have done of the information, that this could have happened without the CIA's hand being involved. I can be wrong. I can't prove that. It's just based upon everything I've seen from the church hearings and all the investigative reporting I've done over. I've broken over 320 major stories that any of this could have happened without CIA and people in the White House being aware that there was a problem and they had to either engage or cover up the official version. I know that you have reviewed this. Now, tying in your understanding of the CIA, having been a CIA analyst, and your national security credentials, having briefed the president's top national security advisor through multiple presidents, tell us what you have found from your own research and what you suspect is the truth at this moment concerning what we can with some certainty say about the 9/11 official report. Lay that out for us, please.
Sure. First off, the 9/11 Commission report was a cover-up. Now, you don't have to take McGovern's word for that. There were two fellows who ran that commission, at least in a titular way, Governor Kaine of New Jersey, former governor, and Lee Hamilton, who is the Democrat that they tried out on such occasions to give an appearance of bipartisanship. Now, Kaine and Hamilton have written a book. And in the book, they say, and this is no exaggeration, they say we were doomed to failure. We weren't given enough time. We weren't given enough money. We weren't given enough access to classified information. We weren't given enough access to real people who know that. So we were doomed to failure. Well, hello? How many Americans know that? I mean, there's a book out on it, signed by Kaine and Hamilton, saying that they were doomed to failure. Okay, now that's number one. So one would ask, well, why would these ostensibly reputable people realize from the outset that they were doomed to failure, find out that they couldn't have access to these things? Why would they put out this report and make all this kind of stuff respectable, in quotes? I don't know. That they operate in a in an environment where power is how you fit in with the establishment, and you don't. When you face a situation like this, you do what the establishment would allow and no more. So, what's the bottom line for me? Bottom line for me is that it is unconscionable to criticize people who are just trying to find out what Kane and Hamilton should have been finding out. Okay? It's unconscionable to talk about conspiracy theorists as though that's something anathema to real scientific approach. It's not. These are incredibly honest people. I am among them. I chaired a meeting of the architects and engineers out in Berkeley about 5 years ago. I have great respect for these people. They're trying to find out what happened and whether, for example, it was gross misfeasance or whether it was malfeasance. Now, people ask me now, Ray, come on, give us a break here. You don't have any doubt. You don't have any problems believing that Dick Cheney would orchestrate something like this, do you? And I say, no, I have no problem. The problem is that I'm an intelligence analyst, okay? And that I feel bound by the evidence. And whereas I believe that Dick Cheney and George Bush and George Tenet and all these other creeps, that they were perfectly capable of doing this kind of thing, I don't do faith-based intelligence. In other words, it doesn't matter what I believe. It's the empirical evidence that will persuade me one way or the other. And just finishing up on this, I've seen all manner of empirical evidence showing not only that the 9/11 Commission report was wrong, was a cover-up, but that there's every reason to suspect that there's something much more nefarious, much worse than misfeasance, was afoot here. One thing that militates against this in a way is, and I'm learning this from investigative reporters, not so much intelligence analysts, that when something really heinous like this happens, Gary, almost always, when you have, well, say at least 50 people involved here, almost always if someone has an extra martini in a bar and tells his girlfriend, "Oh, you want to know what really went down here in 9/11? Well, I was one of those guys that did fix up those buildings, said they would go down the way you didn't." Well, there's been none of that. And, that's not persuasive one way or the other. But I guess my investigative reporter colleagues say, one would really expect something like that if it were a mammoth operation. There's one other thing here that hits a raw nerve, and very few people are willing to discuss this. Motivation, okay? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, okay, what do they call him? The spiritual author of this whole operation on behalf of Osama bin Laden. Okay, what about him? Well, in the midst of the drafting of this report, the 9/11 Commission report, we're talking, 2003, 2004, 2005. In the midst of that drafting, these young people, working away on staff, find out, they read the Washington Post, say, "Hey, guess what? Guess what, Fred? They've got KSM. Okay, KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Well, they got him. I know what we'll do. Hey, we're supposed to find out why he did it. Hey, let's go ask the CIA to ask him why he did it." All right? This is the way these things work. It's so simple. Hello, of course. So they send these questions to the CIA. Now, the answer they get back is in a very small paragraph on page 147 of this otherwise incomplete report. And it says this. You see, these folks knew that that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had an engineering degree, mechanical engineering, from the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And so they figured, wow, maybe that had something to do with this. So maybe he had an affair of the heart there, or maybe some cops called him a raghead or something. Yeah, it's probably him. Well, this is the way the answer came back. Quote, KSM's motivation was not, by his own admission, he was not motivated by any animus to the United States as a product of his studying here, but rather his violent opposition to U.S. policy favoring Israel, period, end quote. page 147, 9/11 Commission Report. Now, am I saying that that was the only factor involved? No, I'm not. One would be foolish in the extreme to omit oil or to omit the U.S. insatiable desire for permanent military bases abroad. But Israel was a main factor. And then toward the end of the 9/11 Commission Report, those young staffers made a real effort to put that into play and say, look, you know, if we want to prevent this kind of thing from happening again, we need to go to the causes. We need to know why they hate us, okay? And a big part of why they hate us is because they identify us with the State of Israel and the kinds of things that they do to the Palestinians and other Arabs. Now, I'm not saying anything that people don't really know, but I am saying something that people never say, okay? But there it is in the 9/11 Commission report. So that's another reason why this is very delicate territory to go into, because Israel is so much involved in this. There are stories about Israelis rejoicing as they watch the buildings burn. There are stories about Israelis sent home immediately at the same time that the Saudis were sent home immediately. All of these things need to be explored, but that's a live wire, and that's one of the live wires that prevents people from going into exactly what happened.
But we can all agree that there's a great deal of inconsistency and contradictions and falsehoods in the official report.
That's for sure. Well, Hamilton and Kane pretty much say that.
All right. I just believe that we should have a completely new, independent, completely independent review.
That's
now,
exactly.
When we have a Congress that votes against an amendment to the Patriot Act that was introduced into the Pentagon budget and would stop the National Security Agency's massive domestic spying on citizens, and this was a bipartisan victory for Obama, we need to seriously question the allegiances of our elected legislators. We also need to seriously question their knowledge about American history and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that they are sworn to preserve, and worry about their qualifications to serve in the legislature. And I'm sure many of our congressional leaders would fail a high school American history exam given their surrealism of their voting records. And a large obstacle we're facing is that Obama and his administration are adamant that the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance is within the constitutional law permitted by the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendment Act. Please deconstruct for us the White House's argument over domestic surveillance. And then second, what does it say about the rule of law in Washington when National Intelligence Director James Clapper and the National Security Administrator Director Keith Alexander can blatantly lie about government spying under testimony, under oath, before Congress, which is a felony, and neither is held accountable for it?
Gary, you ask, as usual, all the right questions here. I've got to doing, in all my interviews now, every one of them, whether it's BBC or a domestic thing here in the United States, I read one sentence, Gary, to put things in context, and that's one sentence. It's called the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, and it reads as follows. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, period, end quote. What could be clearer than that? Probable cause. Probable cause is out the window with these NSA programs. Particularly describing the place to be searched or the persons or things to be seized? Forget about it. We could collect everything. The technology, it's much easier to collect everything and just categorize it and then be able to retrieve it than, target the people because they're probably, because there's probable cause against them. So unreasonable seizures and searches and seizures, that's what we've got, on steroids. Now, the question that people don't understand is, well, yeah, but Congress passed some laws. Okay, let's take the misnomered Patriot Act. Okay, well that was bad as on its face, but there's a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and that's what is, quote, enabling, end quote, the NSA and everybody else to do this this business against the Fourth Amendment. Now, I feel really strongly about this for a lot of reasons. Let me just be brief and cite a couple of them. When I worked in the intelligence agencies, when I worked for the CIA and I had very close relationships with the NSA and National Security Agency and others, actually I worked for the director under his hat as supervisor of all these agencies, not just the CIA, and that director's name was George Herbert Walker Bush, okay? We had a real Donnybrook when Cy Hirsch and other people talked about and wrote about what we called, quote, the family jewels, end quote. Now, this was the unconscionable efforts during the 50s and 60s to use drugs, to use all kinds of assassination techniques, and to use eavesdropping. And, of course, that was J. Edgar Hoover on steroids, almost four decades of having the book not only on congressmen and senators, but on presidents, okay? Now, Frank Church, the senator from Idaho, had the guts to convene a church hearing, both cameras, in other words, both the House and the Senate, to look into these things. And to his credit, Bill Colby, who I quoted before and for whom I worked directly, turned out to be a lawyer first and foremost, to have respect for the Constitution first and foremost. And so when Henry Kissinger told him, look, you can't divulge the family jewels, just lie to them, you know, like Dick Helms did before you, Colby said, thanks very much, but I'm a lawyer. I'm sworn to tell the truth before the court and before Congress. I'm going to tell the truth. And he did. And he released all this stuff. And Kissinger ended up firing him, of course. And Colby knew that would happen. But what did he release? Well, among all this business was the illegal eavesdropping, wiretapping in those days, by J. Edgar Hoover. And so Frank Church and the others decided, well, we need some very stringent legislation to prevent this in the future. And they did so. 1978, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, made it a felony to do this kind of eavesdropping without a court warrant, okay? That's why the First Amendment out there at the National Security Agency, when I was working in the intelligence community, was thou shalt not eavesdrop against Americans without a court warrant, period, end quote. That was literally, they referred to that as the First Amendment. If I got an intercepted message, Gary, and it looked a little bit like somebody had put holes in it, well, they had. They had. And you know why? Because the names of Americans were razored out of that piece of paper. Not blackened out, razored out. That's how seriously the people at NSA took the law. Now what happened? Cheney and Bush come in. Cheney says to this fellow, Michael Hayden, who's now all the rage on the TV shows with Bob Schieffer and the rest of them, he says, so, you know, this First Commandment's for the birds. We're gonna eavesdrop on Americans because we just need the information. Now, when did he say that, Gary? When do you suppose? After 9/11? No! Before 9/11! And we have the people out in San Francisco who are siphoning off this stream of information from AT&T and Verizon. We have that holding us before 9/11. Now, after 9/11, of course, it went on steroids. So what happened was these generals, and General Hayden, and now General Clapper, former General Clapper, and the general that I call Alexander Not-So-Great, that's Keith Alexander, who not only heads up NSA now, but heads up one of the most forceful, one of the most important commands in our U.S. services, our armed services, and that is the U.S. Cyber Command. Both of them, all of them, lying through their teeth, demonstrably lying through their teeth, because thanks to Edward Snowden, we have the documents that prove that not only they, but the president himself, in his interview or his press conference just 3 days ago, was also either lying through his teeth or woefully misinformed, and we can prove that from documents. So what we have now is a situation where the president is saying, oh, well, you know, I was going to fix it anyway. it reminded me of my teenage kids, you know. I said, well, why don't you do the dishes? Oh, I was just going to do the dishes. I was going to fix it anyway, says the president. And so Snowden is not a hero. No, no, he's not a patriot. No. Give me a break. Senator Wyden's deputy chief of staff was on Amy Goodman this morning. And for those of your listeners who didn't see it, they really owe themselves this treat. She was very, very respectful. She didn't call the president a liar, you know, maybe a little prevarication or a little exaggeration, that kind of stuff. But she pointed out for 5 years, she, on behalf of Senator Wyden, did everything they could to expose what the NSA was doing, and Bush, they let Freudian slip, Obama and his folks wouldn't do diddly about it. And so she's saying, well, that's really neat. He was just about to do it when it was ludicrous. So what's happened now is that the tide is turning. And when we had this vote just a little bit, 10 days ago, I guess it was, they almost revised the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act in a way that the Fourth Amendment would be sort of, not altogether, but sort of more honored, okay? But again, I go back to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. You know, we have the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment egregiously violated and sort of boasted about this violation by our President Obama.
Okay. I'm going to add something to that, because you mentioned Michael Hayden. Most people don't realize that he was the former CIA director and the National Security Agency chief, and he is a general, and he's been all over the media. He's considered America's top expert, or one of the handful, on supporting the National Security Agency surveillance programs and attacks on Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. How much of the illegal domestic spying should General Hayden be charged with? And share your assessment of the White House's current opposition and aggression towards whistleblowers such as Snowden, M. Drake, and Biney, and some of the others. And I, today on a program, I read a brief article by John Kirikou from The Guardian entitled, "Shame on this President for Persecuting Whistleblowers with a Legal Relic While Administration Officials Leak with Impunity, Obama's Abuse of the Espionage Act as Modern-Day McCarthyism." And he goes in to talk about his own case and what he was charged with, his great crime that didn't come out until afterwards. It wasn't just espionage. He was charged with a simple thing of a conversation with a New York Times reporter about torture. And he gave no classified information, only the business card of a former CIA colleague who had never been undercover. And the other espionage charge was for giving the same unclassified business card to a reporter for ABC News. All three espionage charges were eventually dropped. But it wasn't about going after him for espionage. It was about teaching him a lesson. And that lesson was that you went from gray, where the CIA operates and the National Security Agency operates, where you can justify anything, to black and white. One of them was torture is black, and he wasn't going to compromise on that. And it was through him that we found out about the Bush era perversion of justifying torture. And Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, declared a war on all whistleblowers virtually as soon as they assumed office. And some of the investigations began during the Bush administration, as was the case with NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake. But Espionage Act cases have been prosecuted only under Obama. The president has chosen to ignore the legal definition of whistleblower, which is any person who brings to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, and has prosecuted truth-tellers. Now, this policy decision smacks of modern-day McCarthyism, and so that is the concern. So could you address these issues, please? And Hayden's pardon. Oh, by the way, did anyone ever find it odd that the former director of the CIA, the only one who actually had the courage to tell the truth, Colby, had such an unusual death? You think he drowned?
That's a whole other program, Gary, but yes, I find that a very suspicious death.
Do you have any insights that we wouldn't have?
Nothing more than Colby, after, even after he left the agency. I used to see him regularly. He was the He was a picture of physical fitness, and he, of course, he was an OSS guy who used to jump out of planes, and he was an expert in canoeing. So the notion that he would have left his dinner half finished, gone out canoeing, and then just had a heart attack is a little bit of a stretch for me. I was overseas at the time, so I didn't really have a chance to look into it closely, but you're quite right. In raising that, it's very suspicious. Let me talk about Hayden. You know, it's a mark of what I call the fawning corporate media that Bob Schieffer would fawn all over this guy who is not only complicit, but one of the driving forces that, quote, justified, end quote, the violations, gross violations of the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution. Now, he was NSA director, as I say, when Bush and Cheney came in. And I mentioned what they said. Don't worry about that first commandment about no eavesdropping on Americans without a court warrant. We're going to siphon off all this information from AT&T and Verizon and the rest of them. And we're going to do all manner of other things. And, of course, when 9/11 came, then all the gloves were off. Okay? Now, when Hayden was up for confirmation as CIA director, there was a really interesting pas de deux here, Gary. I'll try to be brief here, but Senator Bond from Missouri, you know, they usually have this stuff choreographed. He says, "Now, General Hayden, when the president asked you to lay on this surveillance, wide surveillance, did you have any hesitation at all? A presidential order?" Hayden blew it. The answer, of course, was, of course not. But he thought for about 20 seconds, and it was very embarrassing. And he said, "Well, I had to think long and hard about this. It was really a personal, But in the end, I decided that I could not do it." Now, God, I'm watching this thing, right? I say, "Well, if it was a legal order, what's your problem, General Hayden?" It was an illegal order, and he did it anyway. So that's Hayden. He's lying through his teeth now, and it's very embarrassing because if the press does its job and compare what Hayden has been saying, not only over the years, but even today or yesterday with Schieffer, they can see from the documents that Ed Snowden has released that he's lying through his teeth. Now, the other thing, let me just say another thing about the way things work in Washington. Now, Hayden, they wanted to make him CIA director after he had been head of the NSA and after he had done a stint in this new superstructure, the Director of National Intelligence. Now, all of a sudden, they want Porter Goss, the CIA director, out of there, so he resigns abruptly, and Hayden is nominated. Now, I have the book on Hayden because I'm watching him all these years. But you know what happens? In the New York Public Library, there's a meeting. And James Risen, who is the New York Times reporter, who reported on these illegal surveillance techniques, and Bobby Ray Inman, who is an admiral, one of the most respected high intelligence officials in this country, got together at the New York Public Library, and they're having this discussion. And they said, "Well, what Hayden did on the eavesdropping, was that legal?" And Inman says, "No way! I wrote part of that FISA law. That prohibited exactly what he's allowed. As a matter of fact, we put another sentence in there saying, you can't do anything that isn't specifically authorized by this law, okay?" Whoa! At about the same time, another previous NSA director, and I should have said Bobby Ray Inman was the NSA director for a long time, General Odom, Bill Odom, he's now deceased, but he's being interviewed about the same time, and he says, "You know that, Hayden? He should be court-martialed. You violate that first commandment over the NSA that we took such pains to ingrain in our people. He should be court-martialed." So you have two former CIA directors, both well-respected, both part of the establishment, one dead, but one alive. Now, why do I mention all this? Well, because I'm waiting in Lou Dobbs's blue room, okay? He was interviewing me because of a dialogue I had with Rumsfeld, which got on TV. And in rushes Bobby Ray Inman, okay? And he said, oh, and Ronan, here, get a tie. He puts on his tie, and I'm saying, oh, good! They're asking him to testify on whether Hayden should be director of the CIA. And I know what he said just a week ago at New York Public Library. Oh, it's going to be great. So I said, Bobby, hang in there. So he goes in, and I'm watching the tube there, and Lou Dobbs says, what do you think of General Hayden as his head of CIA, Bobby Ray Inman? Excellent. I couldn't think of a better choice. Highly qualified, extremely bright. He's the best man for the job. And I'm saying to myself, McGovern, that's the way it works in Washington.
That's a good place to bring us up to the end of this program. Just a final thought I have. Journalists and historians have noted how the U.S. is embarking on a path that is not dissimilar to the Weimar Germany's evolving into Hitler's Nazism. In 1933, there was the Enabling Act that severed the balance of power between the German cabinet and then-Chancellor Hitler. In effect, it destroyed the democracy of the Weimar Constitution and permitted Hitler to have plenary executive powers that were dictatorial. As a senator, Obama stated that no president should be above the law. Yet during his first term, he signed 145 executive orders, which puts him on a track to sign more executive orders than any president in history. And back in January, he signed 23 executive orders on with gun control alone. And as I see it, executive orders can pave the way for executive branch to wield more power to institute its agenda against the will of the people in Congress. No one would say that we have a dictatorial government yet. However, I believe that we are allowing the development of the executive branch to enable them to be dictatorial and usurping seniority over the other branches of government that in effect can be regarded as dictatorial and therefore enabling fascism and a police state. I'm not comparing and do not want to for a second compare Obama and this administration with Hitler's Germany. I'm merely saying how Hitler got to power and how through the Enabling Act being severed. So when you take away the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, and to our Constitution, where they simply are no longer relevant to those in power, then you enable those individuals who are seeking power for whatever their ultimate objective or those and others who are working with them to be virtually unstoppable. And therefore, in conclusion, I believe that it's only through a grassroots effort where we, the people, begin to find enough confidence and courage to challenge these individuals and to bring people forward who will be elected solely because they represent true constitutional values and democracy in its best form, such as Jill Stein or Dennis Kucinich or Gary Johnson or Rocky Anderson. And the left has rejected this. The left has rejected any conspiratorial notions that they exist. They've completely exempted any responsibility for even looking at the research on 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination or any of the other things we discuss on a regular basis with scholarship. And that's unfortunate. Ray McGovern, we thank you for being a guiding light and a lightning rod for the type of clarity and insight and acumen that we need to help maintain our intellectual perspective and proper balance on these issues. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm Gary Nall, website raymcgovern.com. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.